These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. These lectures are titled Emperors of Rome, Part 2. Lecture 13, Power and Poison, Agrippina and Claudius.
Hello and welcome to Lecture 13 of the Teaching Company's course on Emperors of Rome. Last time we examined the first half of Claudius's reign down to the death of Messalina in October 48. From all that we've seen thus far, it seems hard not to conclude that Claudius was indeed heavily influenced by his wives and freedmen, pretty much as the ancient sources have it. Some scholars seek to mitigate the impact of these advisers on Claudius's reign, and no doubt there are gross exaggerations in our ancient accounts, especially in the matter of the emperor's almost numbing passivity. But what happened in the wake of Messalina's fall tends to reinforce the impression of the dominated Claudius by several orders of magnitude. For into Claudius's life stepped a woman so powerful and so domineering that she was practically an empress of Rome in her own right. This was Agrippina the Younger, the sister of Caligula, wife of Claudius, and the mother of Nero. That vita speaks for itself. Her full story, however, is a fascinating and checkered one, and that occupies our attention for most of this lecture. Roman legends celebrated upstanding women of the deep, fictitious past, such as Lucretia, who, despite being blameless, killed herself when raped by a prince rather than bring dishonour on the names of her father and husband. But the hoary tales of the Roman past also enshrined a quite different female archetype, as represented by Tullia, the daughter of Rome's sixth king, Servius Tullius. Tullia first seduced and then conspired with her brother-in-law to put him on the throne. Unfortunately, her plan required the murder of her husband, sister, and even her father, all crimes which Tullia carried out quite willingly. She even took the extra step of driving her chariot over the prostrate corpse of her father, and thus showed her total disdain for family, custom, and decency. Tullia represented to the Roman male mind what happened when women succumbed to political ambition and aspired to public life. Roman noblemen grew very nervous at the prospect of independent and influential women. It is well to remember that our ancient sources for Agrippina, written by men familiar with the Tullia paradigm, may well strive to align the facts on the ground with the set expectations of how ambitious women behaved. We have already seen how these expectations tainted the reputations of powerful women like, for instance, Livia, suspected baselessly of involvement in all sorts of mischief. Likewise for Augustus's daughter and granddaughters, disgraced and exiled to small islands. Plancina, the wife of Piso, was deeply implicated in his crimes in the east, and only got off due to the intervention of Livia. Livilla had supposedly forsaken her own husband Drusus, and then poisoned him, all to help the villainous Sejanus. Then came Messalina. Clearly, in Roman male eyes, once women moved into political circles, they lost their femininity and succumbed to unfettered ambition, sneakiness, and lethal duplicity. Particularly harrowing was the prospect of female involvement in military affairs. Mark Antony's wife Fulvia was the immediate model for this particular horror. She had raised arms against the young Augustus in 41 BC, putting on a sword, haranguing troops, and planning military operations. She hadn't been successful, of course. Tacitus summarizes Tiberius's misgivings about the favor enjoyed by the elder Agrippina, wife of Germanicus, among the soldiers of the German legions as follows, and I quote, "Already Agrippina was more influential with the armies than legates, than leaders. The woman had suppressed a mutiny which the princeps's name had been unable to stop," unquote. And that was the mother of our Agrippina. Bearing all this in mind, let us now trace the tumultuous life of Agrippina the Younger down to the year 54. Agrippina, like her brother Caligula, benefited from the wild popularity of her father, Germanicus, and her direct descent from Augustus. She was his great-granddaughter. She could also claim descent from the popular Drusus the Elder, brother of Tiberius. Her pedigree was therefore proud, but her childhood marred by tragedy. She was the fourth child of six, born on the 6th of November in the year 15 or possibly 16. Her birthplace was the German frontier in the winter quarters of the legions. The place was later granted the status of a Roman colony, a fact that stands behind its modern name, Cologne. Her father perished, as we've seen, far from home when she was a toddler, and in her mother and namesake, she had a powerful and headstrong role model, a woman who went toe-to-toe with the Emperor Tiberius and his minion Sejanus. But as a teenager, she also saw that her mother's head-on approach only earned her exile and premature death. Her family decimated, the 13-year-old Agrippina joined her older brother Caligula in Livia's care. In 28, she was married to the nobleman Cneius Domitius Ahenobarbus. As was customary for Roman wives, this development required her to move into the new and unfamiliar surroundings of her husband's house. It must have been a daunting experience for a 13-year-old. Such then was the shape of Agrippina's childhood and early teenage years. They were times of tension, tragedy, and fear. She would have learned early the need to conceal her feelings and deceive. For a child of Germanicus under Sejanus and Tiberius, those skills could make the difference between life and death. As an imperial princess, she was well educated, and she kept up her literary interests after her marriage. Tacitus tells us that he himself had actually consulted memoirs written by Agrippina herself, and other authors corroborate the existence of this document. It is, of course, lost, but it shows that Agrippina had some literary talent. Agrippina's memoirs, according to Tacitus, and I quote, recorded for posterity her own life and the disasters of her relatives, unquote. It is not clear from this when Agrippina wrote her memoirs or how much of her life was covered by them, but it does show that our surviving sources are, at least in part, informed by one of the major players in the events they describe. Agrippina's husband, Cneius Domitius Ahenobarbus, was not a nice man. Suetonius calls him detestable in all aspects of his life. But he did come from a very prominent family. The Domitii Ahenobarbi, Ahenobarbus means bronze beard in reference to a reddish tinge in the beard, had been providing consuls to Rome for generations. The family had a quaint habit of naming sons only Lucius or Cneius in alternating sequence. But the Domitii also had a reputation for arrogance, intemperance, and ostentation. Agrippina's new husband, for instance, was among the first men in Rome to build a lavish set of baths onto his house, and one of his ancestors had ridden an elephant through Gaul while coming home from a campaign. The Domitii were, in short, show-offs. Agrippina's father-in-law, Lucius Domitius, had thrown gladiatorial games at Rome of such excessive brutality that Augustus, who was no stranger to violence, had publicly reprimanded him. Agrippina's husband was consul in the year 32, and he too liked his violence. He is reported to have run over a boy in his chariot on the Appian Way, accelerating specifically to get him. And during one quarrel, he gouged out the eye of an equestrian right in the middle of the forum during a quarrel. Domitius's sisters, who were both named Domitia Lepida, were no more pleasant and had reputations for stinginess and promiscuity. Such was the family of which the 13-year-old Agrippina now found herself a part. But at least they were prominent and well connected. We do not have a lot of information about Agrippina's life under the last years of Tiberius. But when her only surviving brother Caligula became emperor in March 37, she emerges from the shadows, and significantly, we find her flexing her political muscle. As we saw in Lecture 10, in his first months, Caligula heaped honours on his relatives, both dead and living. Agrippina, along with her sisters, was granted all the rights of the Vestal Virgins, which brought, among other things, the right to basically front row seats in the spectacles. Their names were now included in the annual vows for the emperor's safety, and, rather unusually, in the official formula for presenting legislation. Even more unusually, they were added to the oath of loyalty offered to the emperor himself, an extraordinary development given that everyone took this oath, including the troops. Now, part of this oath for Caligula has survived in an inscription, and it reads, and I quote, "I shall not hold myself or my own children dearer than I hold Gaius and his sisters," unquote. Coins showed three sisters, and they were all named Drusilla, Agrippina, and Julia, so they're on the coins as well. Clearly, Caligula loved his sisters. In fact, rumours abounded that he loved them, shall we say, a lot. But as we saw back in Lecture 10, there is good reason to think that the claims of childhood incest in our sources are later, well, either fabrications or exaggerations that are aimed at fixing Caligula more firmly within the parameters of behaviour held to be typical for a tyrant, so we can't take them at face value. Also, honouring his sisters in 37 may have been a sign of genuine affection, or perhaps it stemmed from some political calculation. Through them, Caligula strengthened his claim to power through his dynastic link with Augustus, who also appears on his coins. And the sisters also may be promised the prospect of dynastic stability and longevity. 37 was an important year for Agrippina, quite aside from the accession of her brother. On the 15th of December in that year, she gave birth to a son. Following the family tradition of the Domitii, he was named Lucius Domitius Ahenobarbus, the father being Cneius, remember. He was born in the family estates at the seaside town of Antium. As the child emerged from a difficult breech birth, he was touched by the rays of the sun, a very favourable omen. An astrologer who was in hand, such men were very popular with the Julio-Claudian emperors, declared that the child would one day be emperor, but that he would kill his mother. Agrippina replied, "Let him kill me, provided he rules," which reveals a certain political hard-headedness. The state of her marriage is suggested by a comment her husband Cneius Domitius made to a guest at the naming ceremony for their newborn son. He said, "I and Agrippina could only give birth to something loathsome and disastrous for the public." Unquote. I don't know about you, but I don't get a very warm and fuzzy feeling about the relationship from that remark. But the comment proved to be prescient. His son, Lucius, was later to be adopted by the Emperor Claudius and renamed Nero. But I get ahead of myself. By the year 39, Caligula's relationship with the Roman upper classes had soured, as evidenced by the reintroduction of maestas charges, the execution of prominent senators, and the indictment of powerful governors. As we saw in Lecture 10, the governor of Upper Germany, Cneius Lentulus Catulicus, decided to act and was suppressed. The real shocker is that we find Agrippina involved in this scandal. Her sister Drusilla had been married to a man named Marcus Aemilius Lepidus, of impeccably noble credentials. This Lepidus was a good friend of Caligula's and, if we believe Dio, had even been named as Caligula's successor. But in 38, Drusilla died and was deified, and this seems to have somehow affected Lepidus's relationship with Caligula, because he is next found connected to Agrippina as her lover. Indeed, he is said to have been involved with both of Caligula's sisters, which reveals Lepidus to be either a thrill-seeker or an idiot. Lepidus, of course, went down with the conspirator Catulicus, and Agrippina was exiled, and several other men were then put to death. The question is, why was Agrippina mixed up in all of this? It's very hard to say. All sorts of political calculations have been surmised by scholars, but none really are any more provable than the other. It is significant that Agrippina's husband, Cneius Domitius, suffered from dropsy and was dead by the year 40. Now, if Domitius was visibly ailing in 39, Agrippina may have been hunting about for a suitable replacement, and the supposed successor to the empire, and recently widowed Marcus Lepidus, fitted the bill rather nicely. Her later political acumen suggests that she went into the plot against her own brother with eyes wide open. Perhaps it was already clear to her that Caligula's behaviour could only end in disaster, and she decided to be an active rather than a passive party to the inevitable outcome. Whatever the case, she failed, and by the end of 39, she found herself on the same small island once occupied by her mother and her brother. Caligula sent her charming notes, observing that he had swords as well as islands. Her son Lucius was taken in by his profligate aunt, Domitia Lepida. Now, Claudius's accession in 41 saw both Agrippina and her sister Julia recalled and their property restored. She immediately gave to Caligula's body a proper burial, a notable act of pietas that repaid in death the honours that Caligula had extended to her in life. By this act, Agrippina also perhaps gained some political traction with those populist elements that really tended to regret Caligula's end. Her activities in the early years of Claudius's reign are not well recorded. Remember, Tacitus's account only resumes in the year 47. But as the mother of a son descended from Germanicus and Augustus, she would have represented a threat to Messalina and her family, and we can imagine that the relations between the two women were strained. Indeed, in 41, her sister Julia was sent back into exile, not even a year after her recall, along with the orator and philosopher Lucius Annaeus Seneca. Julia and Seneca may have been up to some mischief or other, but the sources insist their ruin was engineered by Messalina, a sign of tension between the two houses. Julia was killed not long into her second exile leaving Agrippina the sole surviving child of Germanicus. Four of that prince's six children, as well as his wife, had now fallen victim to political intrigue, a fact that tends to illustrate the fate awaiting losers in the game of Imperial Roman politics. A major event of this phase of Agrippina's life was her second marriage to the Roman equivalent of Oscar Wilde, the wit and socialite Gaius Sallustius Passienus Crispus. Crispus was the one who said of Caligula that there had never been a better slave nor a worse master, and on a different occasion, when Caligula asked him if he'd ever enjoyed the sexual favours of a sister, replied demurely, "Not yet." He was also extremely rich and very old and didn't survive the decade of the 40s, all to Agrippina's advantage. Sometime in these years, Agrippina gained influence with Claudius's trusted freedman and secretary of finances, Pallas. The freedman had come to distrust Messalina after she ruined one of their colleagues in 46. So, in this way, Agrippina's connection to Pallas placed her in a strong position just prior to Messalina's fall and proved pivotal in its wake, when Agrippina made her boldest move yet. Messalina's death left Claudius a hollow man, emotionally numb and disengaged. This only deepened his usual passivity, as the sources have it. He needed a wife, as his regime was now more vulnerable than ever, alienated as it was from the elite and now stripped of the useful political links Messalina had provided. The freedmen set to work to convince Claudius to marry this or that woman. Pallas, naturally enough, advocated for Agrippina, who buttressed her claim with hugs and kisses and long private meetings with Claudius. As she was Claudius's niece, his marrying her would be scandalous, but it did carry many political advantages. Through her, Claudius could tap into the vast reservoir of affection for Germanicus that still watered popular perceptions. Her son, Lucius, was a direct descendant of Augustus himself. Both of these circumstances could be expected to strengthen Claudius's regime. Even if the emperor's decision to marry Agrippina was made in response to lobbying by Pallas, it was, in reality, a clever move. A law was passed redefining incest to legitimate the union, and Claudius was duly remarried for the fifth time in 49. Agrippina had arrived. Naturally, our sources see this development as the dupe Claudius swapping out one domineering wife for another. And in reality, Agrippina and Messalina do not seem that different from each other, except really in the matter, perhaps, of modalities. Agrippina was more disciplined and less given to profligacy than had been Messalina, and she was less inclined to conceal the strength of her influence. In fact, she wanted her position in the state publicly and openly acknowledged in a way that no imperial woman before her and few after desired. Male authors like Tacitus depict her with barely concealed terror. Influential, she certainly was, and signs of her influence were made manifest immediately. Claudius's daughter Octavia was betrothed to her son Lucius. To make way for Lucius, Octavia's current fiancé, a man called Lucius Junius Silanus, first had to be ruined with a scurrilous charge of incest with his sister. Such were Agrippina's methods. Silanus then committed suicide on the very day Agrippina and Claudius got married. The year 50 proved a monumental one for Agrippina. She herself was conferred with the title Augusta, the first consort of a living emperor to be so honoured. Remember, Livia had received the title in Augustus's will, and Caligula had also granted it to his grandmother Antonia a few weeks before her death. But Agrippina was the first wife of a living emperor to receive this title. This title conferred upon her a public prestige and an officially sanctioned prominence that no empress before her had enjoyed. She began to receive morning guests in the ritual called the Salutatio, which was usually reserved for the male head of the household. She also starts to appear on the coins, her likeness occupying the entire reverse side with the inscription Agrippinae Augustae, which just means to Agrippina Augusta. The emperor's bust and titles occupy the obverse as usual. Coins from Ephesus went so far as to put Agrippina's image on the same side as Claudius's in a sort of echelon profile behind the emperor's in the format called a jugate. Nothing like this had been seen in Roman coins before. In 52, when a British resistance leader was captured and brought to Rome, he paid homage to Claudius sitting on a raised tribunal, but also to Agrippina, who occupied her own tribunal, equally as imposing, beside Claudius's. It was a striking sight. The partnership of emperor and empress openly recognized. But Agrippina's most notable achievement was the elevation of her son Lucius. For all her influence and prestige, she could never hope to rule the Roman world in her own name. Claudius was old and increasingly feeble. His days were clearly numbered. But through Lucius, Agrippina could look forward to decades of continued prominence. As the great-great-grandson of Augustus, Lucius had a strong claim to the throne. He was slightly older than Claudius's natural son Britannicus and was clearly popular with the masses. His intrusion into Claudius's succession scheme could be justified as natural and entirely logical. Augustus, after all, had favoured elevating multiple princes, as had Tiberius before Sejanus messed everything up. So why not elevate young Lucius? Next, Seneca was recalled from exile and put in charge of educating him. And this added another ally at court to the roster of Agrippina's friends. Then in 50 came the master stroke. Claudius adopted Lucius as his son. There can be little doubt that the emperor knew fully what he was doing by effectively eclipsing his natural son. He must either have seen deficiencies in Britannicus, there are hints that the lad was an epileptic or perhaps a dullard, or else he saw some political benefit in bringing Lucius into the fold, or both. Either way, on the 25th of February AD 50, Agrippina's 12-year-old son, Lucius Domitius Ahenobarbus, became Nero Claudius Caesar Drusus Germanicus, or just Nero, as he's more commonly known. The Arvals held a sacrifice in celebration, which is how we know the exact date. The usual signs of favour followed. In 51, Claudius became consul to see Nero adopt the gown of manhood, a ceremony at which Nero was named also Prince of the Youth. He was allotted a consulship for the year 58, and he was given proconsular power outside the city, and he was elected to all the priestly colleges. In 52, aged only 14, he was made prefect of the city, a post usually occupied by a senior ex-consul. Nero now begins appearing on the coinage too, usually with Claudius on the obverse, as was usual for ruling emperors, but sometimes with Agrippina displacing Claudius on that side, or even Nero himself resident on that very honoured surface. It was unprecedented in imperial coins for the emperor to be wholly absent from his own coins. At circus games in 51, Britannicus appeared in the toga of childhood, while Nero was resplendent in purple magisterial robes. There could be no doubt as to who was intended to succeed. Agrippina's recent biographer, Tony Barrett, makes an interesting observation about these years. He notes that our sources record far fewer executions and forced suicides among the upper classes under Agrippina's influence than under Messalina's. The fact is, all the more striking, since we have Tacitus's full text for the career of Agrippina under Claudius. It certainly cannot be that Tacitus omits such deaths from his narrative. Far from it. He would want to highlight them as evidence of Agrippina's skullduggery. Rather, their frequency genuinely tapered off after 48, which implies that Agrippina and Claudius managed the affairs of state more successfully than had Messalina and Claudius. Far from the grinding masculine tyranny noted by Tacitus, Agrippina's ascendancy seems to have brought, if not some form of collaboration, then at least a rapprochement between emperor and senate. But if so, it didn't save Claudius. According to Tacitus, the emperor, who by now had become an habitual drunk and a virtual glutton, declared one night in his cups that it was his fate to tolerate his wife's outrages and then to punish them. Terrified, Agrippina decided on preemption. In consultation with a professional poisoner with the name Locusta, she prepared a slow-working potion and gave it to Claudius on a plate of mushrooms. But an excess of wine and the timely bowel movement saved the emperor's life, so more immediate measures were required. A fast-acting toxin was smeared onto a feather, which a doctor then used to tickle the back of the emperor's throat as an emetic. This did the trick, and Claudius perished on the 13th of October, 54. Now, Suetonius and Dio tell rather different stories. They both credit Agrippina's fear to Claudius's increased displays of affection toward Britannicus, which jeopardized Nero's dominant position in the succession. Dio then follows Tacitus's version of events and recounts the murder of the emperor, but he only has one mushroom doing the trick and there's no mention of a second dose as being necessary. Suetonius, however, comments that while Agrippina is generally believed to have poisoned Claudius, there is much dispute over the details. All this uncertainty leaves open the possibility that Claudius died naturally, the timing of his end fortuitous rather than forced. He was 63 years old. He had been a heavy drinker and overeater for many years already, and he'd recently been prone to illness. He'd almost died in 53, so we can't rule out natural causes. It must also be said that if Claudius had come to suspect Agrippina or was somehow favouring Britannicus, no signs of these attitudes surface in the official record. Agrippina remained unchallenged and Britannicus in the shadows. More suspiciously, we note that the charge against Agrippina closely echoes that levelled against Livia, who was rumoured to have poisoned Augustus because he had begun favouring his wayward grandson Agrippa Postumus and was thus threatening the accession of Livia's son, Tiberius. In other words, callous empresses poisoning decrepit old husbands to clear the way for their sons is something of an imperial leitmotif, and we should be on our guard before accepting such tales at face value. Suetonius declares of Claudius, "Wholly under the control of his freedmen and wives, he behaved not as an emperor, but as a slave." That assessment is enormously malicious and exaggerated, but it does contain, I'm afraid to say, a kernel of truth. Claudius had been effectively debarred from the councils of state for most of his life and had kept the company of domestics, that is, women and freedmen. Despised by his peers as a cripple and an idiot, and forced by the soldiery and an unwilling senate, he continued to rely heavily on the advice of these domestics during his reign. That the likes of Messalina, or Pallas, or Narcissus, or for that matter Agrippina, turned out to be self-seeking, greedy and duplicitous is hardly surprising. Claudius was not the first, nor indeed the last Roman emperor to be surrounded by malignant toadies. What seems clear enough, however, is that he did give an unusual latitude of action to his household, a situation regarded as unbecoming of a Roman nobleman, never mind an emperor of Rome. His ancient critics like to linger on this point, giving rise to the sort of brutal assessment offered by Suetonius just quoted. A more difficult question is to what degree Claudius was complicit in the actions of his satellites. That is, were they acting against his wishes and on their own agendas, as the ancient sources would have us believe? Or were they really front men for the regime? That question is almost impossible to answer from hard evidence. But it is noteworthy, all of the ruinations perpetrated by Messalina or Agrippina worked to Claudius's political benefit by removing opponents and rivals, and this is unlikely to be pure coincidence. On a fair assessment, Claudius's reign must be judged more or less successful. He was conscientious and careful, he took his duties seriously, and he achieved some notable results, like the invasion of Britain or the building of the harbour at Ostia. He may have been a bit of a fuddy-duddy, a bore even, and he certainly had his nasty sides, but he holds up well in comparison to the likes of a Tiberius or a Caligula. And compared to what came next, Claudius was a veritable giant of statesmanship. Agrippina's prominence, earned and then exercised under Claudius, was to continue in the coming years, even increase. But it all ended in tragedy. And this we shall see in the next lecture.